Ted made a good joke on the Bema. He noticed that we are deep towards the end of Deuteronomy. He said, we're almost running out of Torah. And I said, we'll probably have to get another one that has Joshua in it. And then I thought something a comedian said, I have Christian friends who really like the sequel. It's very hard to pull off a sequel with a new character, but they seem to have done it. And it's a fascinating structure for a parsha. I think it was Ivan who noted this at Minyan, and I've always thought about this. I think it's one of the only two cliffhangers in our parsha, because throughout the parsha of Vayelech, it's speaking of a poem that we will use more or less as a mnemonic. But the poem it's referring to is next week's parsha, Ha'azinu. A very queer setup to speak so fondly and so admiringly of something yet to come and not to address it right in the same week. So I'm led to some questions when you think about the value of the poem as it's described in the parsha as so a learning tool, a pedagogic. And this talk I want to give might be more suitable to Chol HaMoed Shabbat during Sukkot, because that's when we read Ecclesiastes, which is of a genre called... anyone know the genre? Wisdom literature, among which we count Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, some would count Job. There is another book called Ben Sirach. You also have things like epigrams in the ancient world, sort of short aphorisms, typically short aphorisms that ponder the nature of life, not in a strictly metaphysical sense. That's the nature of Ecclesiastes, but also Ecclesiastes deals with epistemology, the origin of knowledge and wisdom. So as Proverbs would say, Proverbs 4:7 says, go get wisdom. So what are the sources of wisdom in our tradition and elsewhere, the pedagogic origins of how we learn? And there are five that arrive in this week's parasha. The first is, one might say, narrative or history or science, sort of the sciences that derive from logic, whether they be strictly sciences or social sciences or humanities, things we receive, so to speak, in textbook form, things we study, review, so on and so forth. So we're told that Moses would write this down, Ha'azinu, but sort of as a synecdoche for all that, Ha'azinu and the whole Torah, and the Torah would be kept as a representative, as an embodiment of Jewish knowledge. And we consider Pentateuch to be the repository of our law and wisdom. And through capital T Torah of Pentateuch, we also, this came up in the board meeting last night, two nights ago, have small T Torah, which is all the forms of teaching that originate in Mount Sinai. So we learn the mitzvah this week. One of the final mitzvot, perhaps the final mitzvah of the Torah, is to write a Sefer Torah. Did anyone attend the Siyum Sefer Torah that Chabad had about 3 weeks ago? Oh, not many. But so I was invited to write a letter, which means you hold the sofer's hand, really, or the sofer holds your hand, which I found, I was surprised how moved I was just doing a little bit of ink. We never get to be so intimate with our Holy Writ. You know, you read it, but you always touch it with a yad. It's the only time I've ever seen the ink glisten. It's very powerful. So we're commanded that each person in Israel should have one's own Torah scroll. If you write it by your own hand, that's very praiseworthy. But if you're unable to, you can commission a sofer, a scribe, to do so for you. And through sort of gathering together in a community, you can have everyone write a letter, and thereby you have done as a miktsa kekulo. If you do, the legal principle is if you do a small amount, it's as if you've done the whole thing. And that's, to me, the notion of knowledge as text, as prose, as literature or nonfiction, one might say, although I'm not going into the question of Torah as fiction or nonfiction. I just mean the written text that we'd find in a book, in a codex or a scroll or a textbook. That's a primary source of knowledge. That's largely the point of high school education into certainly sciences education and some liberal arts education. And then there's another form I want to address, which I find very dear, arts. prose, and then poetry and other arts. So this interesting debate, we talk about Hashira. It's continually referred to in this week's parasha as Hashira, the upcoming song, which will be Parashat Ha'azinu. And it's when you get up to see it, it's written in a different strophe form. So there's two; it's a two-column form for poetry. And that's also true. No, it's not true of Shirat Hayam, but there are a couple places in the book where we see unusual orthographic patterns, the ways it's written in difference to the way it's normally written in a single column. So Rashbam and Rashi, medieval commentators, debate what's the song that's referred to and what's the Torah that's referred to. So Rashi, I think, says that God or Moses is only talking about the next parsha, Ha'azinu. But Rashbam kind of straddles the fence and says that it's part of the references to the song, the poem, and part of the reference is to the greater corpus of capital T Torah, the Pentateuch, and small T Torah, learning. I think sort of the two, probably what they're describing in some ways, unbeknownst to them, was left brain and right brain learning. Sort of critical analytical learning and metaphoric and artistic learning, which, as we know, neurobiologically reinforce each other. And I think, as I've said before, when kids, it's typically high schoolers, ask me, do you think the Torah is factual or true? And I say, I think it's true, but not factual, which I've explained, I think it was in this room maybe 3 weeks ago. The example I use is the movie Casablanca. So, and sometimes I'll use it in contrast to Saving Private Ryan, for example, movies that try to be more factually accurate about depictions of the war. Casablanca, to me, is much truer than a history book. Was there ever a Rick or a Rick's Café Américain or an Elsa or a Laszlo? No. There were people like them. But is it true that people sacrifice a great deal for the world and for love? Absolutely. Was there a Cain and Abel? No. To my way of thinking, not factually, these were not flesh and blood humans, but they were. Is there sibling rivalry that can lead to murderous rage and violence? Yes, that is true. And so I've often suggested that if God, even if we take the presumption that God wrote the Torah, which I don't think is that hard to defend in some ways if you follow this logic, why would God write us in a textbook? A history or science book, why wouldn't God write a poem? That seems to be a much more powerful way of expressing. Poetry and art reaches the heart. Science and history reaches the head, both important. And I think, again, two sources of knowledge. So a third of the five, I think, is teachers. Who's had a great teacher? Who's had a lousy teacher? Okay. The lousy ones, hopefully you can forget, but the great ones are indelible. And that's the truth about Moses, the idea of him being the greatest of our teachers, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, our dear teacher. Mary Linda was noting the sort of the beauty with which Moses' death is described, and I said all the more so in Midrash. There's something that roused a great deal of sensitivity and empathy for our sages in reading Moses' final days. And among the things they say is that Torah doesn't tell us where Moses went on his final days, but there is a classic Hasidic teaching that says Moses entered into the core of every Jew of every generation so that every Jewish soul possesses a spark of Moses. Yeah, that feels true to me too. Whether it's factual or not, is less important than I think it's true. And that's the nature of teachers. I remember very fondly soliciting a college professor to win a teaching prize. But that's a night of college I remember very clearly. And I think of my mentor, one of the rabbis who trained me for the years when I started, I would think, what would Dan do? It was just his birthday yesterday. And I imagine we all can think of people like that in our lives, whether they were nominally teachers or not, but those who have taught us and inspired us and under whose example we live. It's a powerful form of education, one of the most powerful. Prose, poetry, mentorship. And then I think our tradition recognizes very highly the importance of review and study. They literally just call it returning or reviewing. But I think they're talking about study more broadly. That if you do not study and review what you have learned, it is as if you have birthed a child but immediately buried it. You've wasted the knowledge. So that's, to go to Ted's point, that's why we return to the Torah every year. We just did it once and continued on to Joshua. We would be showing a disrespect and a disregard for the immense wealth of wisdom, knowledge, and truth within our scroll. So let's see if we can construct this mentally. There's a story in the Talmud in Eruvin that I can almost picture. It's like a logic experiment, but I'm sure the math works out, but I can't quite do it in my head. So follow along and tell me at Kiddush if you can do it. The rabbis say, this is in the Talmud in Eruvin, what is the method, and they're referring to, this passage starts with a reference to our parasha. What is the method of learning the traditional Torah in the days of Moses? Moses learned it from God. I wish we had seats. So Moses gets it from God and sits. Then Aaron comes in and sits to Moses' right, and Aaron learns from Moses. Then he leaves, and his sons, Eleazar and Itamar, come in. Then they leave. Then the elders come in, and Moses teaches them. So Moses has taught them four times. When the elders were through, they depart, and the larger mass of people, the body politic, would come in. Moses would teach them. So Moses has taught four times. That I remember I calculated. So at this point, Aaron studies, they haven't left, I'm sorry, they haven't really left. Aaron has learned it four times, his sons have learned it three times, the elders twice, and the people twice. Then Moses goes, and Aaron teaches so that would be the elders and the people. Then Aaron finishes, his sons teach, then the sons leave, the elders teach. That way, so it works out that everyone gets to learn it, I think it's four times, they say four times, and I can't do the thought experiment in my head, but I'm pretty sure it works out. That's how it works, right? Like, to learn something, there was a calculus teacher, and one of my great teachers, who made a comment, you really don't need to memorize your integrals. You just use them a lot, and you'll learn that cosine and sine are connected that way. That's the nature of Jewish learning. I mean, that's why, again, in just a few weeks, we're going to roll the Torah back to the beginning and immediately start again. Never stop. Don't stop reviewing. You can always relearn the same things. There have been times some of you have been in class with me. I said, oh, did I teach this already? And usually the response is, teach it again. Can't hurt. And that's the point. Chazara, review, is really stressed by our sages. Not just technical knowledge, not just arts knowledge, not just having a good teacher or mentor, but spending time working on the issue, the text, the structure, the learning, the halakha. It's not easy. Our tradition isn't easy, neither is calculus. But with time and application, or as Malcolm Gladwell points out, that 10,000-hour principle, you can become expert at anything if you have 10,000 hours to do it. There's a lot of things you wouldn't want to spend 10,000 hours on is the issue. So the fifth thing, and maybe this isn't the fifth piece of learning. I was debating when I was thinking about this talk. Is it five learnings or four learnings that lead to a fifth thing? But I want to talk about inspiration. Right? There's that moment it all clicks. Is that sort of an innate neurological divine epiphany, or is that an outcome? We could debate, but let's say it's the fifth subject I want to speak to you about. So in this parasha, we see the handing off from Moses to Joshua, which, if anyone follows, the legacy of the civil rights movement is also described, that Martin Luther King was the Moses generation, and those who descended from him in the 80s, 90s, and to today are of the Joshua generation. We see that. It's a good metaphor for a lot of events in human history. But this is the parasha where Moses first addresses God. The Eitz Chaim will point that out to you. I think it's on page 1173, if I recall. That's it. That's what you wait for. That's the end of the book of Exodus. That's the moments that Moses goes into the tent. Preparation leads to inspiration. And we could, again, debate whether that's its own structure of knowledge or just the fortuitous outcome of the first four. But with technical knowledge, arts knowledge, teaching knowledge, and repetition comes sort of assimilation and synthesis of wisdom. And I think also within that process is the transition from knowledge to wisdom. Tomato is a fruit. An intelligent person knows tomato is a fruit. A wise person doesn't put a tomato in a fruit salad. Right? That's something Arnold taught me. And there's a whole list of modern epigrams like that. That's the transition. And we'll talk more about things like this, I suspect, on Sukkot when we read directly from Ecclesiastes. And when you read Proverbs, which is well worth reading, or even Ben Sirach, which is not canonized but also worth reading. The wisdom literature and literature, Eastern literature, literature of the Greco-Roman era, this struggle, this structure, this work to attain knowledge and use knowledge to grow in wisdom. And our sages would say, having knowledge lead to action. That's the work that we're engaged in right now in Shabbat Shuvah and the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the period from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, but truth be told, ideally it never ends.